Welcome back, everyone. I hope you've had a relaxing break. And so the first talk of winter 2021 is going to be by Cenk Zhu. So Cenk got his PhD at Berkeley, then was a junior fellow at Harvard. And since 2010, he's been a professor of physics at UCSB. So Cenk is very well known for his work on strongly correlated and topological phases of matter, as well as aspects of quantum physicality. And I guess that's what we are going to hear about today. So Cenk, please, you can start.
Okay, yeah. First, let me thank the organizers for putting together this great series of talks. It's a great service to the entire science community. Given the special situation we are in right now. So today I will talk about higher form symmetries at quantum critical point. If you are not that familiar with higher form symmetry, I will give an introduction about this during the talk. So first, let me acknowledge my collaborators. So Xiaochuan Wu is a graduate student in my group. He's extremely talented. And he did calculations, pretty much all the calculations in the works I'm gonna present. And Wen Jie used to be a student in Xiaogang Wen's group. Now she's a postdoc in my group, and she taught us all the cool new concepts that she and Xiaogang developed recently. And also Chao Ming used to be a postdoc in Santa Barbara. Now he is a faculty member at Cornell. So first I will give a brief review, a very elementary review of a higher form symmetry, and also a categorical symmetry, which is introduced by Wen Jie and Xiaogang recently. So I will try to move on to describing what is called a one-form symmetry, ODO. ODO means an order diagnosis operator. I will define this in my talk at a class of quantum critical points. And then I will talk about higher form symmetry and systems with subsystem symmetries. And then I will give some quick comment about the relation between entanglement entropy and also order diagnosis operator. Actually, I have a few more slides about what is called a strange correlator about one form ODO. So I'm not sure I have time for that, but if I do have time, I will briefly get to that. So the reference, there are two papers. One is already online. The other is about to be online, hopefully. Yeah. Okay. So first, let me introduce the generalized symmetries. So we know that, certainly symmetry is the most fundamental concept in physics, and symmetry is always associated with conservation. A conservation law always implies a symmetry, and ordinary global symmetry in a d-dimensional space, here d-dimension means spatial dimension, ordinary global symmetry in a d-spatial dimension, it means that the conserved charge is actually the charge of the entire space. For example, for a system with a U1 global symmetry, then the conserved charge could be the total particle number in the entire space. So suppose we restrict our charge in a subsystem, in still a d-dimensional subsystem with a boundary, a d-dimensional subsystem in the entire system, then the change of the charge inside the d-dimensional subsystem V can only change through the current flowing in and out of the boundary of this d-dimensional system. So it means that actually for the ordinary symmetry, now we call it a zero-form symmetry. The ordinary zero-form symmetry, the charge actually is defined within a d-dimensional subsystem, and the current is going to be a vector. So the concept of higher form symmetry is also associated with a conservation law. I mean, actually, of course, there are a more sophisticated definition of the higher form symmetry, but I find this definition probably the most intuitive. So the one form symmetry is actually associated with like with a vector, like a conserved charge. So basically the conserved charge is actually a vector of flux penetrating any D minus one dimensional subsystem. For example, suppose we consider a closed surface, a closed D minus one dimensional subsystem without boundary. So let's imagine the three dimensional system, but we consider a two dimensional subsystem and the two dimensional surface is a closed surface. So the one form symmetry is associated with the conserved flux penetrating this two dimensional surface. Okay, it's all the vector flux penetrating this two dimensional surface. And suppose this two dimensional surface has a one dimensional edge, then the flux penetrating this two dimensional surface can only change through a one form symmetry charge current flowing in and out of this boundary. So now the current will be a two form current, flowing in and out of the boundary. Okay, so this is a very basic introduction about the higher form symmetry. So now let's look at some examples. Oh, by the way, please interrupt me if there's any questions, okay? So let's look at some examples. So the simplest example with a one form symmetry is the Z2 gauge theory with an exact Gauss law constraint on the electric field. So I assume people are familiar with the Z2 gauge theory. So here I will just write down the most important term, in my opinion, which is the Gauss law constraint. It says that the product of the electric field, Z2 electric field, around every corner, around every vertex has to be one, So it means that if I view sigma x equals to one as a no string, and a sigma s equals to minus one is a string, then it means that actually, the string cannot really terminate. A string has to be a loop. And because the string has to be a loop, then suppose I draw a closed surface. Okay, suppose I draw the closed surface. This means that there's always be like a there's always going to be the even number of electric flux through this closed surface. So it means that the Z2 electric flux is always conserved mod Z2. Okay, so we say the Z2 gauge field has a Z2 one form symmetry because of the Z2 flux conservation through any closed surface. Okay, so the Z2 one form symmetry. Okay. The Z2 one form symmetry does not only happen in the Z2 gauge theory, it can also happen in other gauge field. For example, it can happen in the U1 gauge theory. So suppose I consider a U1 gauge theory, but actually this U1 gauge theory is a little bit special. I only allow the electric charge with an even electric charge. So, more precisely, I only allow even electric charge to be dynamical or mobile. Okay, so it means that there are particles carrying two charges, but there's no mobile particle carrying a charge one. So now we can see that. So suppose I draw a closed surface. If I draw a closed surface, you can see that the electric flux penetrating this closed surface is also always conserved by mod two, because I suppose I move this electric charge from inside the surface to outside of the surface, then the electric charge penetrating the closed surface will change from two to zero. It means that the electric flux number will also conserve the mod two, okay? So it means that in this U1 gauge field, there's also a Z2 conservation of the electric flux. So it means that this U1 gauge field also have a Z2 one-form symmetry instead of a U1 one-form symmetry. Okay. So what is the advantage of introducing one-form symmetry? So the one-form symmetry was introduced like a few years back. Actually, when I first saw this concept, I also asked myself this question: what is the advantage of introducing the one form symmetry. So after a while, I convinced myself that it's actually a very useful way of looking at physical systems. So for example, introducing the one form symmetry actually give us a unified perspective of many gauge theories. So as I said before, I mean, as the examples, so for the Z2 gauge theory, if the Gauss law constraint is actually imposed strictly, there's a Z2 one form symmetry. And for U1 gauge field, actually, so depending on the charge assignment, there can also be a Z2 one form symmetry. And also for the SU2 gauge field, suppose we only allow the adjoint matter field, but we do not allow mobile SU2 fundamental matter field, then the SU2 gauge field also have the Z2 one form symmetry. So that means that actually this introduction of the one form symmetry is kind of like a unified picture or unified language describing many gauge field. We know that different gauge field actually may have very different dynamics. There's a deconfinement and a confinement, asymptotic freedom. Those are dynamics of the of different gauge field. But actually sometimes actually by introducing the one form symmetry, we can focus on the unified feature of different gauge field. Okay, we can look at the unified feature of all the different kind of gauge field. For example, we can discuss the Z2 one form symmetry spontaneous symmetry breaking, and this can happen in all the gauge field with the same Z2 one form symmetry, despite their different dynamics. Okay, and also, introducing a one form symmetry or more generally a higher form symmetry give us a new language and new insights of understanding many physics which we used to view as a non-Landau physics. So we know that, for example, the ordinary Landau physics correspond to spontaneous symmetry breaking or not breaking. There's a Landau theory describing the phase transition of symmetry breaking phase and non-symmetry breaking phase. But usually we view the topological order as something non-Landau. And we also view, for example, the emergent U1 symmetry and emergent photon phase as a non-Landau physics. But actually after introducing all the, the one form symmetry, it turns out that all the non-Landau physics may have a Landau language description. For example, the topological order can be viewed as a spontaneous breaking of a discrete one-form symmetry. And also the photon phase of emergent photon, emergent U1 gauge field, the Coulomb phase, can be viewed as a spontaneous breaking of the U1 one-form symmetry. So that means that a lot of the non-Landau physics we have discussed before, we have for a long time viewed as non-Landau, may have a Landau description. Okay, so now this actually give us a poses an interesting question. I mean, well, I don't have an answer, but actually I think it's an interesting ask. So is there a more authentic non-Landau physics that cannot be described even by spontaneous breaking of the higher form symmetry? Okay, so well, this is an open question. I don't have an answer right now. Okay. Another which I think is a very good example to demonstrate the power of a higher form symmetry is actually some anomaly analysis. So in physics, we know that in condensed matter, we know there are some Lipschitz-Mallier theorem saying that a certain system cannot be trivially gapped without a ground state degeneracy. So it turns out that introducing the language of one form symmetry, we can actually prove that some gauge theory with a certain topological term also cannot be trivially gapped. So this goal was actually achieved by viewing the one form symmetry as an actual symmetry and analyzing the mixed anomaly introduced by the topological term. And actually when they say Terhoeft anomaly of the higher form symmetry actually it dictates that the spectrum cannot be trivially gapped without ground state degeneracy. So the same conclusion may be observed from different perspectives, but actually using the one form symmetry actually can be argued or proved in a most clean way, okay, in the cleanest way, in a cleanest and a nice way, I think. Okay. Question? Yeah, sure.
So for the example of SU2 with adjoint matter, do you assume the adjoint matter is gapless?
No. They can be gapped. Yeah, they can be gapped.
So right. So in that case, below the gap of the adjoint matter, do we say there's some... So what do we say in that case, below the gap of...
Well, I mean, in that case, I think there's still a Z2-1 form symmetry because I think the gauge boson itself transforms as a joint on the SU2. So this question becomes more relevant for the U1 gauge field. For the U1 gauge field, if we say we allow massive charge 2 matter field, but they are gapped, we can say that actually at the low energy, there's even an emergent U1 one-form symmetry, but the system has a fundamental or microscopic Z2 one-form symmetry. So one special thing is that even with the emergent U1 one-form symmetry, the spontaneous breaking of the emergent U1 one-form symmetry can still lead to Goldstone mode, which is the photon. This is very different from the zero-form symmetry. Yeah, right.
Okay, and then about the non-Landau physics, suppose I have a gauge theory with gapless matter. Do you consider that as non-Landau?
So that's very subtle. So depending on the representation of the matter field, we have to. Well, I mean, because they're gapless, so actually we have to think about what exactly is the one-form symmetry. And also the spontaneous breaking of one-form symmetry is also a subtle thing that we need to define. Actually, I will give a definition later this talk.
Maybe just make sure. So for SU2 gauge theory with gapless fundamental matter.
Yeah, no, there's no one-form symmetry at all.
Then do you consider it to be non-Landau or?
Well, if there's no symmetry, then it's hard to talk about Landau or non-Landau physics. Let's see. I don't know. Sorry. Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, as I said, this is not a maybe not a even a such a well-defined question, and I don't have a general answer. I'm just saying this may be a direction worth thinking about.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Okay, so let me introduce another concept called a categorical symmetry. Well, actually, you don't have to worry about the word categorical here. Since within this talk, we don't really need to know what the categorical is. So I'm just going to give you my understanding of the categorical symmetry. So let's look at the first example when people discuss the categorical symmetry. So it actually concerns a very well-known duality. It's a self-duality between the transfer field Ising model. Okay, so we know that transfer field Ising model originally takes this form, and under some duality transformation, it self-dual. It just exchange K and H. Okay, the sigma three term becomes interaction between tau three and tau three term. It exchanges the K and H. Okay, but actually we can also immediately see that this self-duality actually is not really, has some inequity between the original picture and also the dual picture. For example, so normally we can say that this model has two phases. One phase has a spontaneous breaking of the Z2 symmetry, which is the ordered phase of sigma three. The other phase should have a spontaneous breaking of the dual Z2 symmetry, However, in the spontaneous breaking of the dual Z2 symmetry, there's no ground state degeneracy. Okay, there's no ground state degeneracy. So that means that there's definitely these two symmetry, the one Z2 symmetry and dual Z2 symmetry, they are not on the equal footing. Okay, they are not on the equal footing. So, but actually how do we treat them on an equal footing? So suppose I say the system has a larger symmetry, has a Z2 original and a Z2 dual symmetry, then how do I treat the Z2 symmetry and dual symmetry on an equal footing? So there are different ways of doing that. So one way is that we can view the symmetry as a boundary of a higher dimensional Torrey code. So it means that the original Z2 corresponds to the Z2 topological symmetry of the E anion of the Torrey code topological station, and the dual Z2 symmetry is the Z2 symmetry associated with the M anion of the Torrey code model. Then actually we can, so suppose we condense the E anion as the 1D boundary of Torrey code, we will get the Ising ordered phase here. If we condense the M anion as the 1D boundary, we get the phase where the tau 3 condensed, but neither condensation will have a ground state degeneracy. So this means that actually in this way, we can actually make the two Z2 symmetry on the equal footing. So another way of making them on an equal footing is to either extend the Hilbert space or constrain the Hilbert space. So for example, actually we know that the ground state of the large K phase actually, usually we say is either or up state or down state. But suppose we just restrict our Hilbert space into the symmetric Hilbert space, which means that it has to be Z2 symmetric, every state has to be Z2 symmetric, then actually we can only consider the cat state. The cat state will be that O up state plus O down state. So so in this way, actually, we also get rid of the degeneracy, and then actually the two Z2 symmetry actually will be viewed as the will be on the equal footing. But actually, so even if we erase the degeneracy of this Z2 symmetry of the original Ising model, the physics is still non-trivial here because there's a critical point. The critical point is largely not affected by this constraint of the Hilbert space. Okay, so the same scenario happens in another well-known duality in 2+1 dimension. They say Ising symmetry. It's a quantum Ising model in 2D, and it's due to a quantum Z2 gauge theory in 2+1D. Okay, so the original model has a ordinary Z2 zero form symmetry. We call it zero form symmetry now, and the dual Z2 gauge theory has a Z2 one form symmetry. Okay, it has a Z2 one form symmetry. So this model still has two phases. Still has two phases. When the K is much greater than H, there's an Ising ordered phase with spontaneous breaking of the original Z2 Ising symmetry. And when H is much greater than K, the system is supposed to have a Z2 one form symmetry spontaneous breaking. As I said before, when there's a Z2 one form symmetry spontaneous breaking, the system is supposed to have topological order using the new language of describing non-Landau physics. But turns out that in this case, the large H phase, it's still just a trivial disordered phase. So that means that actually the Z2 symmetry of the original model and the Z2 symmetry of the Z2 one form symmetry of the dual Z2 gauge theory, they're still not on the equal footing. They're still not on the equal footing. So suppose we want to describe the original Z2 symmetry and a dual Z2 one form symmetry in the same framework and on an equal footing, we will have to develop a certain level of the new tools to describe symmetry and a symmetry breaking.
Okay. Thank you. Quick question. Hi, how are you doing?
Hi, John.
Yeah. It's wonderful because I remember well that I was kind of confusing myself about this whole issue, right? There's a sort of missing treatment of degeneracy in the duality. Question is simple. Are both in 1+1 and 2+1, these are seemingly relatively trivial exact algebraic dualities, right? You can just write down operator identities, fill them in, and you go from one to the other. Where is that going wrong? You would think that when it's a plain, honest algebraic procedure, that there shouldn't be room for this kind of surprise, that you need this extra thing in order to get the degeneracies right. Do you have any clue?
I don't fully understand the question, but actually,
Again, it's simple. You look in the textbook, and there's this Count Fournier duality, right, in two-dimensional, 1+1 dimensional Ising, right?
Yeah.
And you just define operators, redefine them, and local operators from non-local, blah, blah. You plug them into to the Hamiltonian, and you get your dual Hamiltonian. Same thing when you go from global Ising to local Ising in two plus one dimensions. They're algebraic procedures. So there should be some place where something is going wrong, because the algebra is not telling you that you need extra data in order to get a duality working.
No, I'm not, well, I'm not saying the old language is wrong. Actually, these examples are really well known, and as you said, almost trivial. So I'm just starting with these almost trivial examples, and then later for systems with more complicated symmetries, for example, with a subsystem symmetries, actually. We do need to use some more systematic tools.
Just interrupt you for a second, Cenk, because Matthew put the answer in the chat box, and that's what I kind of expected. It's boundary. To be careful, it's a boundary.
Oh, sure. Yeah, right. So a lot of this can be resolved with the boundary, but I'm saying that. The boundary effect is a case-by-case study. You know, I mean, for a lot of this duality, we may have to study the boundary case-by-case. I'm saying that we don't need to do that. Suppose we introduce some new language and new tools, we can get around the boundary effect, like the well-known boundary. I mean, so to make the duality works in the one-to-one Ising model, we need to worry about the boundary, but actually, suppose I don't want to do a case-by-case study of the boundary, then we can still understand these dualities, but actually we have to develop some new tools and new languages. So how about let me continue, and suppose in the end, if you still have these comments, we can discuss these questions later. So trust me, I had a similar concern, a similar comments when I first see this new introduction of concepts of symmetries. My question, just like you, so is this really anything new, or just a rephrasing the old physics, rephrasing the old physics? So trust me, I had the same concern. So how about let me continue, and then later we can, if in the end with you there's still this concern, then we can discuss that, okay? Yeah. So let me try to use a more systematic way of describing this duality, okay? So first of all, suppose we don't worry about the boundary, okay? And I still want to understand the duality, and most importantly, I still want to treat the explicit symmetry and the explicit dual symmetry on the equal footing. So actually, there are certain things that we'd better not use to describe a system anymore. For example, we'd better not use the order parameter or the ground state degeneracy to describe the spontaneous symmetry breaking. But actually, one thing we can use is the correlation functions. So we know that even if we use the cat state, even if we use the cat state of the Ising model, the Ising variable will still have a long range correlation. So the correlation function is still a good quantity we can use, which actually avoids the question of the ground state degeneracy and order parameter. So what is the generalization of the correlation function of one form symmetry? So it turns out that for ordinary one-form symmetry, the analog of the correlation function is just the Wilson loop for the ordinary one-form symmetry, just the Wilson loop. And we know that in the gauge theory, the Wilson loop actually has can have a parameter law or can have the area law. So we can view the parameter law of the Wilson loop as the definition of the spontaneous breaking of the one-form symmetry. And we can view the area law of the Wilson loop as the one-form symmetry preserving phase, as a one-form symmetry preserving phase. Okay, so in general, we can call either the correlation function or the Wilson loop as something called an order diagnosis operator. So here I actually introduce this word because actually later we will discuss systems with a subsystem symmetry. So that's actually a more complicated version of the of the symmetry. So in those cases, actually, what diagnoses the order and the symmetry breaking is not the correlation, nor the ordinary Wilson loop, is something else. So actually, in general, I would call this a order diagnosis operator. But actually, for the simplest zero-form symmetry, the order diagnosis operator, the ODO, is just a correlation. And also for the simplest one-form symmetry, the ODO is just a Wilson loop. Okay, and yeah, so just like for the 1D Ising model, we can define the correlation or the ODO for the original Z2 Ising symmetry. It's just a correlation of sigma 3, and for the dual Z2 Ising symmetry, the ODO we are going to use is just the tau 3 correlation, and this operator will create a pair of kinks. So we know that in the two phases. In the K much larger than H phase, the Oij will have a long range expansion value, and O2 will have a short range correlation. And in the large H phase, then the O will have a short range correlation, but O2 will have a long range correlation. Okay, so now the question is that, so now the more interesting question will be what happens at the critical point. So we know that there are two phases. In one phase, one of the Z2 is spontaneously broken. The other Z2 is actually not spontaneously broken. In the other phase, the other Z2 is spontaneously broken, but the original Z2 is not spontaneously broken. Then what happened at the critical point? So for the 1D case, actually, the critical point is actually very, very simple. We know it's soluble. It's an Ising CFT. Then both ODO, we have a power law correlation. So in this case, at the critical point, neither Z2 symmetry is spontaneously broken. Okay, so it means that in the 1D Ising model, both of these Z2 symmetry, they are actually preserved as the critical point. But the situation is actually very different in a two-dimensional quantum Ising model. In a two-dimensional quantum Ising model, the Ising correlation function is easy to compute. In the large K phase, the Ising correlation function is long-ranged. In the Ising disorder phase, the short range, and at the critical point, we know that we have a well-developed Wilson-Fischer fixed point theory to calculate the Ising correlation function. And for the dual one-form symmetry ODO, which is the Wilson loop has a parameter law in the disorder phase, has the area law in the ordered phase, because actually the dual Wilson loop actually creates a domain wall for the Ising order. Create a domain wall of the Ising order. So that actually, if you just evaluate the domain wall creation, you can see that this operator has an area law in the Ising order phase because the domain wall is actually suppressed, and has a perimeter law in the Ising disorder phase when the Ising domain wall actually kind of proliferate. This can be calculated. But actually, again, the interesting question is actually what happens as the critical point, as the Ising transition. Okay, as the Ising transition, we know very well that the Ising correlation function actually is a power law, but actually what happens to the dual Ising one form, to a dual Z2 one form order parameter, which is the Ising domain wall creation operator. So does it have an area law or perimeter law or something in between? Okay, this actually turns out to be, well, to the best knowledge of mine, it's actually not a known question until recently. Okay, until recently. So we need to know the behavior. We need to know the behavior of the Ising domain wall creation operator, or in our general account, we call it ODO. We need to know the behavior to judge whether the dual Z2 one form symmetry is spontaneously broken or preserved as the Wilson-Fischer Ising transition. Okay, so it turns out that there's a numerics done recently. Okay, this is not our paper, it's a paper by other colleagues. So in this paper, they show that as the Ising transition, the dual one-form Ising ODO, or the domain wall creation operator, still has the perimeter law. But actually, besides the perimeter law, there's a log term. So it's L plus log L. Okay, it's not L times log L, it's L plus log L. So L is the length of the domain wall, and the log L is the log of the length of the domain wall. But this log term only arises when the system has a has a corner, has a sharp corner. Okay. In fact, they computed the case for the rectangle. So for the rectangular shaped one form ODO, there's a linear term and also there's a log term. So this actually is very reminiscent of the entanglement entropy. Okay, this is very, very much reminiscent of the entanglement entropy. Okay, we know that for the entanglement entropy, there's a parameter law, and also there can be a corner induced. There can be a corner induced log coming from some UV regulation. Okay, so here let me give some general comments, results of some universal features of a one-form ODO as a class of quantum critical points. So so far we have defined the one-form ODO, and as I said, let me reiterate what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to calculate the expansion value of the one-form ODO, and actually in most cases just a Wilson loop. I'm trying to calculate the Wilson loop as the as a class of a quantum critical points and try to evaluate the behavior. So the claim is that for a class of quantum critical points with one form symmetry, either the one form symmetry could be either explicit or inexplicit as a dual symmetry, the one form ODO actually receives a parameter law, and also it also receives a universal or UV independent subleading log term coming from sharp corner, okay, coming from sharp corner. So suppose I calculate a Wilson loop like this, or we can view this as a domain wall creation, which means I create a domain wall inside this a little bit weird shaped loop here. Then this corner will contribute a log. Okay, this corner will contribute a log term, and this log term is universal, is UV independent, and the function of the corner actually looks like this. Okay, it's a little complicated, but it can be written down. It can be written down. Okay, so here the one-form symmetry can be the explicit one-form symmetry, or it can be an inexplicit dual one-form symmetry. Okay, and actually this exponent sigma, actually is related or is proportional to the universal conductivity as the 2+1 dimensional quantum critical point. We know that for two plus one dimensional quantum critical points, there is a universal conductivity. Okay, universal conductivity. So it turns out that this corner. We don't have to pay much attention to the linear term because the linear term is UV dependent anyway. It's not really a universal, but the log term is universal. The log term, first of all, has a function of theta like this. And the second is proportional to the universal conductivity as a 2+1 dimensional quantum critical point. Okay, so that's a general statement. So let me talk about examples. So is there any question before I talk about examples?
Is this F only applicable to the geometry you showed before?
Say again?
Is this F of theta only applicable to the geometry you showed here?
No. I mean, so this is for one single angle for different shape with a different angle, you add up all the angles together.
I see.
Yeah. Thanks. If it is smooth, you can see when theta equals pi, this actually becomes zero. Yeah.
So just a quick question about conductivity. Which conductivity you are talking about? Is thermal or some charge?
I will get to that. Yeah, right. So it will become clear when I talk about this example. So let's start with a simple example. It's a Zn order disorder example. So when n equals to 2, this is just the icing. It's just the icing transition I talked about before. But actually, in general, we can talk about Zn order disorder phase transition, and also we can define the Zn domain wall creation operator, and it becomes a Zn one form ODO. Okay, Zn one form order diagnosis operator, and actually, unfortunately, we are not able to calculate the icing case directly. But actually, when n is greater or equal to 4, actually, it's well known that the Zn order disorder phase transition just becomes it's actually enlarged into a 2+1 dimension XY transition, and the Zn anisotropy becomes irrelevant. that becomes irrelevant. So that means that actually for the this transition, the Zn order disorder transition, can be described by this field theory. This is Jinsub Landau field theory, and the dual theory is this. It's a famous particle vortex duality, and then the dual theory is a vortex coupled with the U1 gauge field, and then the Zn anisotropy is due to a monopole operator with a power n. Okay, so in this case, this operator, this O2, is the domain wall creation operator for the Zn. It's a domain wall creation operator for the Zn. And n, this n here is a Zn particle number. Okay, Zn here is a Zn particle number. And because at the critical point, the Zn theory can be embedded into a U1 theory. Okay, the Zn theory can be embedded into a U1 theory. So actually we can use what we know about the U1 theory to do the calculation. So for example, this N is one component of a current, of a U1 current J. And this U1 current J is dual to the DA, dual to the DA. A is the U1 gauge field of the dual theory. And then the ODO, evaluation of the ODO, which is the evaluation of the domain wall creation operator, becomes the evaluation of the Wilson loop, and it becomes the evaluation of the gauge field correlation. Okay, becomes the evaluation of the gauge field correlation. But turns out that actually as a 2+1 dimensional critical point, the AA correlation function is dictated by the JJ correlation function, and the current correlation function is actually pretty much fixed. Okay, it's pretty much fixed. The reason is that the scaling dimension of the current operator at the critical point is not renormalized. The current operator has a fixed scaling dimension, and also it's conserved, so its form is pretty restricted, okay? It's pretty restricted. So it's basically proportional to a universal function and a coefficient sigma. And this sigma is proportional to the universal conductivity at the 2+1 dimension XY transition, and this quantity has been studied extensively, in the last few decades, using numerics or even can be measured experimentally. Okay, okay. So that means that actually, the AA correlation function, even though this is a strongly correlated conformal field theory, a lot of things can be calculated in a very controlled way. For example, the AA correlation function determined by the JJ correlation, which actually is determined by the universal conductivity. But again, to calculate this, it requires a little bit of subtlety, because actually we need a UV regulation, and a UV regulation can break the gauge invariance. So we have to be careful to keep the gauge invariance. And actually, after we take care of all this subtlety of the UV regulation, we will get the desired form, which is this.
Shankar, can I ask a question? So is there a simple way to think about why at this particular value of n equal to 4, the anisotropic effect become irrelevant and collapse to xy, not at n equal to 8 or other value?
We know that when n equals to 8, it's definitely going to be irrelevant. But actually, for n equals 4, it's hard to see why it's irrelevant. But this has been studied a lot in the classical Monte Carlo. People study classical XY transition and turn on Z4 anisotropy, and they know it's irrelevant. But actually, right? I don't know.
Okay.
There's a fundamental reason why n equals 4 is the critical value. One really has to read the data from the Monte Carlo, which actually it's actually quite convincing, because actually they can do very large scale for classical Monte Carlo.
Is it related to the square lattice or some lattice geometry?
No. It's completely just a Wilson-Fischer transition.
Okay.
So it should be lattice independent. It should be lattice independent.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
And just short follow-up. Yeah. The first reflex to say that the anisotropy becomes irrelevant above NS4 by power counting. I guess the reason is a lot more subtle than just tree level or something.
No, I didn't say n equals 4 is irrelevant due to power counting. Actually, for power counting, you will see...
anisotropy, right? You scale to full XY, so you lose the Ising anisotropy or the C4 anisotropy. Henceforth, the anisotropy operator is irrelevant at the fixed point.
Yeah, but that's not
because... Right, and then the question is, can you discern that from just power counting tree level?
No, for power counting, it's going to be relevant. For power counting, you have to count it at the Gaussian fixed point. At the Gaussian fixed point, n equals 4, yeah, sure. And yeah. Anisotropy is relevant. So one really have to read from the Monte Carlo data. There's a normal dimension which makes it irrelevant, but not the power counting. Power counting will tell you n equals to 7.
Yeah. Somewhere it kicks in, but you really need to go many loops, so to say, to
know. Yeah, right. Or you can calculate.
I believe it's just curiosity.
Okay. So now we can also consider another class of theories. So this is another class of theories with a explicit ZN one-form symmetry. So this is a class of QED theory. As I said before, for a QED theory with a charge N, usually there's a ZN one-form symmetry. Okay, this is a ZN one-form symmetry. So we can consider a class of theory like this. Okay, so it's going to be it's a combination of a flavor of the fermion number and also the charge number carried by the fermion and also the Trans-Simons term level K here. So we can try to calculate the behavior of the ODO for this group of theories. Okay, and these theories actually have multiple applications. So for example, when NF equals to 2 and N equals to 1 and K equals to 0, this actually is also a transition for the for a system with a ZN symmetry. But it's not a transition of the disorder, I'm sorry, it's not an order disorder transition of a ZN symmetry, it's a phase transition between a ZN SPT, ZN symmetry project topological state, and the ZN trivial state phase transition. So So for NF equals 2, N equals to 1. Okay, so this actually is I should have made it more clear. So here the ZN is actually the conservation of the flux. Sorry, it's a different ZN, but actually, yeah, this theory actually describes a trivial to SPD transition. It's not describing order disorder phase transition. So actually, yeah. So this theory, actually, we can also calculate the one-form ODO. This theory, if we calculate the one-form ODO, it will take the precisely same form as we had before, but with a different sigma. So basically, for all the ODO, actually, turns out that the general form of the scaling of the ODO or the disorder operator actually takes pretty much the same form. It's dictated by the current-current correlation and scaling dimension of the current. But the only thing which changes is the universal conductivity. For different CFT, there's a different universal conductivity, but the log term actually takes pretty much the same form. And there's another interesting theory, which is the NF equals 1, and for some N, and K equals 0. And this theory is a theory with an explicit one-form symmetry. And in this theory, actually, we can calculate the one-form ODO exactly, because of the fermion vortex duality developed in recent years. Okay, because of fermion vortex duality developed in recent years. So it turns out that this theory has at least has a conjecture dual, which the dual to a fermion coupled to a ZN gauge theory. Okay, so it turns out that when N equals to 1, actually this theory is just dual to a single free Dirac fermion. But for larger n, actually, is due to a Zn gauge theory. But this Zn gauge theory, is due to a Dirac fermion coupled with a Zn gauge theory. But this Zn gauge theory is actually gapped, so it does not change the IR physics of the dual theory. So that means that because everything is still determined by the current-current correlation, and the dual theory, the current-current correlation, can be computed exactly. It's just a free fermion theory. Then for the original theory, even though it's strongly interacting conformal field theory, we can evaluate its one-form ODL precisely. Okay, it's given by this formula. Okay, it's given by this formula. So that means that the universal conductivity actually can be computed exactly. Okay, and this theory actually can be realized as the boundary, as a 2D boundary of a three-dimensional SPD phase. It can be realized as a 2D boundary of three-dimensional SPD phase. And this is the case where we can calculate the sigma and also the ODL precisely.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
It's also related to this, but just for simplicity, maybe go back to the XY, the ZN case you asked.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so this object, you said that for the ZN case, it can be interpreted as some kind of domain wall correlation functions. Does it have a direct interpretation in the XY model? Presumably something that has to do with vortices?
Yeah, that's an extremely good question. So you can see that here, I only talk about Zn, but not U1. The reason is that for a system with precisely U1 symmetry, the order disorder phase transition is driven by condensation of vortex instead of a condensation of a domain wall.
Right.
So actually, for the U1 symmetry, I've asked different people who are actually expert of categorical symmetry. Actually, for continuous symmetry, the concept of categorical symmetry is not that well developed yet. So here, so just to be timid, I always start with the Zn. So I have a well-defined disorder operator, which is the domain wall correlation operator. And then I can embed this domain wall correlation operator in the U1 theory and calculate use the U1 theory. But actually, I'm not exactly sure what to calculate for exactly U1 theory. But because their disorder is driven by the vortex condensation instead of domain wall proliferation. Yeah, but that's a very good question. I've thought about this and struggled with this myself. But you know, eventually I just decided to be timid and just calculate what can be defined in the ZN theory, not the U1 theory. And one can easily think about what do we calculate when the symmetry is even bigger, like SO3. So what is the analog of the dual one-form symmetry? There the answer is even harder to get, I think. So yeah, but these are very good questions to ask, actually. Yeah.
All right, thanks.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Anyway, so here, I mean, yeah, right. So basically, we can also calculate the behavior of the domain wall correlation or the Wilson loop or the ODL, whatever we want to call it, with this general NF, N and a K theory. Okay, NF is a fermion flavor number. N is the charge carried by the fermion, and K is the level of the Trans-Siemens term. So for this theory, we have to be careful because actually for different level K, this theory could have a one-form symmetry anomaly, But so we have to select K carefully if we don't want to have any anomaly. So by the way, this is another advantage of introducing a one-form symmetry, because actually we can tell what theory can be realized as a 2D theory when we have a gauge field. Because actually for some K there could be a one-form symmetry anomaly, which means that this theory can only be realized as a 2D boundary of a higher dimension SPT with a one-form symmetry. Well, anyway, so here we have chosen K to be a multiple of N squared. So this theory can be realized in 2D through some subtle construction, of course. And this theory is a topological transition between different topological orders. So again, we can calculate the Zn ODO, Zn one form ODO, and actually still it takes the general form. Both the Trans-Siemens term and all these NF and N will contribute to the log term. Okay, the log term coefficient now will actually contain all these coefficients in certain way. Okay. So I hope this calculation will be useful in the future when people have to worry about the phase transition between topological order, and people are interested in how this higher form symmetry behavior as a topological phase transition. Okay. So is there any other question before I move on to subsystem symmetries?
Actually, I have a question about the anomaly you just mentioned.
Yeah, right.
So I want to understand better, to what extent can we say that for this one form or higher form symmetries, when you have an anomaly, you can't quite realize it. Let's say for zero form symmetry, we say that if you have an anomaly, you cannot realize that if your Hilbert space is a local tensor product and the symmetry is realized locally as a product in a product form. Now, if you have higher form symmetry, at least if you have exact higher form symmetry, your Hilbert space is not a local tensor product to begin with. So
yeah.
What does not realizable really mean?
That's also a very good question. Yeah, I mean the way so far my interpretation of the higher form symmetry anomaly is when you try to gauge the higher form symmetry,
right.
The background gauge is not gauging there anymore. So that's
right.
it's more mathematical way of viewing it. But actually, indeed, it's a good question. How do we understand it using the you know, the standard language for example, the product of a local Hilbert space, this kind of picture. Yeah, that's also a very good question. I also don't have a good answer. I'm very sorry.
Oh,
yeah, so far we can, okay. Well, I think formally, mathematically, one can compute whether there's an anomaly or not,
mm-hmm.
by gauging it. You know, I know that's not a very physical way of saying that, but you know, but formally you can get the answer.
I see. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay, so let's
Chengke, have another question about the Zeon order disorder transition. So when n equals to 2, that's Eisen transition, you don't get to the symmetry enhancement, so you don't have a concept.
Right.
Point.
Yeah. I mean, although numerics shows the answer is still perimeter plus log, but actually the trick I presented here doesn't work for Ising. I'm sorry about that. But so later I'm gonna have I will have a very quick, maybe not a very explicit comment about the relation between entanglement entropy and these ODOs. Maybe it's gonna be helpful there. But right now the trick I presented does not work for Ising. I'm sorry. Yes.
Okay.
Right. Okay. So far we talked about ODO and also so far the form of the order diagnosed operator, they are simple, because actually for the zero form symmetry they just correspond to a correlation function. For higher form symmetry, they just correspond to Wilson loop. But actually, in the last few years, system with subsystem symmetries has become very popular, and actually the whole field of fracton kind of rely on that. So let's try to think about, suppose the system has both the one form symmetry and also some subsystem symmetry, what's going to happen to these ODOs? So let me first just introduce a very simple model. This is a model which actually I and Liang Fu played with for a totally different reason, like a long time ago. So the first term of the Ising gauge theory takes the standard form, it's a plaquette form. But actually, instead of ordinary sigma one term, we have some sigma one times sigma one term as the electric field term. Okay, so this is not ordinary Ising gauge theory. We just changed the form of the Hamiltonian. So it turns out that this model have a series of subsystem symmetry. You can check that it has a lot of subsystem conserved quantity. For example, if I make a product of sigma x, you know, sigma three on every X link, but I make a product along the Y coordinate, along the X coordinate, then this actually is conserved. It's conserved on every row, and there's another quantity which is conserved on every column. Okay, so this is conserved on every row, this is conserved on every column. So it has a lot of sub-dimensional, one-dimensional conserved quantity by making a very simple change of the Hamiltonian. So now in this case, suppose I still just consider the ordinary ODO, for example, the ordinary Wilson loop as the order diagnosis operator. We know that in the ordinary Z2 gauge theory, then actually in the large K phase, in the phase with large K, then the Wilson loop will have a perimeter law. But here in this case, because of this subsystem conserved symmetry, in the large K phase, the Wilson loop no longer has a perimeter law anymore. It has a corner law. So corner law means that the expression value of the Wilson loop, it only decays when the loop takes a turn. It does not decay with the length of the loop anymore. It only decays when the loop takes a sharp turn on the lattice. The reason is very simple. The reason is that the Wilson loop basically is just a product of different segments of this conserved quantity. Okay, Wilson loop is a product of different segments of this conserved quantity. It means that when this Wilson line is completely straight, there's no decay at all because it's conserved. But it will decay when it takes a turn. Okay, so basically this Wilson loop will actually decay according to how many turns it takes on the Wilson loop. Okay, so this model also has a dual. The dual is called a placate model, I think. So this model is due to a icing theory, just like the Z2 gauge theory is due to an icing model in 2+1D, and this Z2 gauge theory with subsystem symmetry is due to an icing model with subsystem symmetry as well. So this is the dual theory. It's a placate model. It looks like icing theory, but it's not, because this tau they are defined on the sites instead of on the links of the lattice. And the ODO for this case is no longer just a correlation function of the two icing variable. It has to be a product of four icing variable on the corners of a rectangle. Okay, of a corners on a rectangle. This becomes ODO. Okay, so again, actually our main interest is to look at what is the behavior of these ODOs. Actually, now the ODO takes a slightly special form. So what is the behavior of these ODOs at quantum criticality? Okay, at quantum criticality. So for the previous theory I mentioned, it's a Z2 theory, either a Z2 gauge theory or the dual Z2 theory with a subsystem symmetry. So both theories can be embedded into a U1 theory. Okay, both theories can be embedded into a U1 theory. For example, the icing gauge theory can be embedded into a U1 gauge theory, which look like this. So instead of an ordinary E square term, there's a gradient X E X square and a gradient Y E Y square term. It takes a special form. And then the dual icing theory, okay, the dual icing theory can be embedded into this theory. Okay, this theory. So this theory is a famous U1 theory with subsystem symmetry. And this theory is actually first proposed by Paramikhandi and my colleague Li Yang and Matthew to study both metal phase. Okay, so turns out that this theory has a critical point or multi-critical point. Okay, so we can evaluate the behavior of the one-form ODO and the dual subsystem icing ODO as the critical point and see what happens. So it turns out that actually both ODOs, okay, behave very differently as the critical point compared with the gap phase. So in the gap phase, both ODO have some behavior which we can compute using perturbation theory. And the perturbation is actually just protected by the gap of the system. Okay, we can see that it has a special corner law or area law or long range correlation. But at the critical point, both operator has some pretty special behavior in space. It has an exponential but a double log decay at the critical point for both ODO, okay? So in this theory, it turns out that the ODO, I mean, so if we recall previous examples, okay, if we recall previous examples, so at the critical point, the ODO, the leading term of the ODO still behaves the same as the ordered phase, as a one-form ordered phase. So we know that the Wilson loop, we have the perimeter law as a topological order and has the area law as the confined phase. But at the critical point, the leading term is still a perimeter law. There's a sub-leading term, which is the log coming from the corners, but leading term is still a perimeter law. But here, with the subsystem symmetry, even the leading order term as the critical point is different from the gap phases. Okay, so this is actually the special thing about the subsystem symmetry ODO. And actually, since I'm out of time, okay, so actually, let me just briefly introduce the higher dimensional example. So we can also slightly modify the Hamiltonian, the higher of 3+1 dimensional Z2 gauge theory, and it's due to another 3+1 dimensional Z2 gauge theory with subsystem symmetry. And actually, we can also define the ODO. Okay, it also takes a special form, And the take home message is that with subsystem symmetry, again in 3+1 dimension, the ODO, we have a different behavior, even as a leading order has a different behavior from the gap phases. Okay, from the gap phases. Okay. So actually, I think because there are a lot of fractal phase, a lot of physics about the substance symmetry, which has been explored in the last few years. Actually, maybe this actually is worth doing. It's worth a more general exploration. Okay. So there's a general comment between the connection between the Rennie entropy and the ODO and the order diagnosis operator. So actually, I mean, you know, so a lot of the things I talk about so far is related to the, seems to reminding people of the entanglement entropy. So indeed, suppose we want to calculate what is called the Rennie entropy. So the way we do that is that usually we make n copies of the system. We make n copies of the system. And when we make n copy of the system, the symmetry, the system is actually granted with the extra swapping symmetry between the different copies, okay? So it means that the Rennie entropy can be viewed as the ODO for the swapping symmetry. So imagine that we take a subsystem, a subregion of the entire space. I only do swapping within this, we only do swapping transformation within this region. Then it turns out this swapping ODO is the end Rennie entropy of the system. So it means that it's possible that we can put the Rennie entropy of the ODO, Rennie entropy and the ODO in the same framework. Okay, so suppose we want to study the Rennie entropy and the ODO of a system with certain intrinsic symmetry, we can enlarge the system. We can enlarge the system by making by n copy of system. So now the system will have extra symmetry. Part of the symmetry comes from the intrinsic symmetry of the original system. Another part coming from a swapping symmetry. And by computing the ODO of the entire symmetry, okay, of the entire symmetry, the enlarged symmetry and the original intrinsic symmetry, we can extract the information of the entanglement entropy and ODO simultaneously. Okay, simultaneously. So there could be a deeper relation between the Rennie entropy and ODO. But so this is a very quick comment about that. Okay. Yeah. So okay. Since I'm out of time, I'm just gonna summarize. So basically, right. So we introduced the concept called order diagnosis operator. The original purpose was to understand to put the explicit symmetry and the implicit dual symmetry on equal footing, and then we realized that to evaluate the ODO, the order diagnosis operator, as the critical point, actually can give us some pretty interesting results. There's a universal logarithmic term coming from the corner, and actually the coefficient proportional to the universal conductivity, which actually in many cases can be measured experimentally or computed numerically or evaluated using all kinds of theoretical measures. And for systems with a subsystem symmetry, actually the difference between the criticality and the gap phase become enhanced. Even the leading order behavior of the ODO is different from the gap phases. So here are the references. Besides our paper, there's another. So this paper was the paper which did the numerics on the quantum IC model, and there's another paper by pretty much the same group of people, including Meng Chen, and Ziyang Meng. They are gonna appear soon, I think. Yeah. So this is my talk. Thank you for your attention.
So thank you, Shenkin, for a very nice talk. So we've had a lot of talks during the talk, but a lot of questions. So during the talk, but are there any other questions?
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
About this second point, I guess I missed what's the general reason for the universality of the logarithmic correction. You gave many examples, but what's the general reason?
Yeah. Right. So right now I can only say with confidence where my trick applies, which is that when there's an emergent U1 symmetry, actually, the calculation actually of the ODO actually is determined or dictated by the U1 current correlation. And that actually has a pretty fixed form due to the conservation of the current. Yeah, right. But for other systems with a different symmetry, actually, I cannot make such a general comment or where that comes from. Maybe just because I don't know. I mean, I haven't understood the general calculation of the entanglement entropy so well. Right. Yeah. So right now I can only say that for a class of system with the emergent U1 symmetry, then there's a general log term arising from the log. And that actually coming from carefully evaluating the log contribution of the UV regulation.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. And for three, what's the intuitive picture that the subsystem symmetry will change the behavior of ODO?
Let's see. Okay, so there's a picture which I think I borrowed from Meng Chen. He has a pretty interesting observation that, for example, for the subsystem symmetry, there is there are a lot of conserved quantities. So actually, conserved quantity put a lot of restriction on the behavior of the order parameter, on the behavior of the conserved quantity. So actually, one interesting connection to make is is the Fermi liquid. So Fermi liquid has a lot of conserved quantity in the IR, and we know for the Fermi liquid, the entanglement entropy behaves very differently from ordinary system. It's always an area times a log area. This kind of a behavior is very different. And actually, I think it has connection with the with a large conserved quantity here. And for system with a subsystem symmetry, the large conserved quantity can also change a lot of the behaviors of the ODO and the entanglement entropy. Yeah, because it gives a very strong constraint on the behavior of the ODO. Indeed, for some of the systems, actually we can calculate analytically. We can see that subsystem symmetry can also give us the can give us L log L behavior instead of L plus log L behavior. Yeah, so in some system we also see L log L behavior. So that's kind of like a Fermi liquid theory. Yeah, kind of like, so I think the large conserved quantity actually give us a lot of constraints and new form of their ODO or entanglement entropy. Yeah, but actually I have not proven this general relation yet. So in general, what does the large number of conserved quantity imply about either entanglement entropy or the ODO? Yeah, that's another interesting question to ask. General question. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Any other questions?
Yeah, actually, I have a question. For higher form symmetry at a quantum critical point, is it possible that such symmetry becomes emergent and in your Hamiltonian levels, the symmetry is slightly broken, but in the
RF? Yeah, definitely. Yeah, right. For example, U1 gauge field. So at the low energy, there could be an emergent U1 cross U1 symmetry. So U1 cross U1 one form symmetry, but at UV, there's no such symmetry. Right. It's totally possible, but actually it's a little bit difficult to talk about Wilson loop or ODO for emergent U1 gauge theory, because the Wilson loop can be screened by the matter field. So actually, we probably have to talk about Wilson loop or ODO for a short length scale, where the matter field is not really excited. Yeah, but certainly the emergent, for higher form symmetry, we can talk about emergent higher form symmetry. The emergent higher form symmetry Goldstone mode, or even emergent higher form symmetry anomaly. So all these actually can be studied and become meaningful. So this concept may not be so meaningful for zero form symmetry, but it become meaningful for higher form symmetries.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
I take it. So at the one form symmetry breaking critical point, is it in principle possible that the Wilson loop operator, say, exhibits something more drastic, such as something between area low and perimeter low, where the exponent of the Wilson loop operator decays as some fractional power of the size of the Wilson loop.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, I don't see a fundamental reason why it cannot. I don't know. I mean, I can't see a fundamental reason why it cannot. Maybe by assuming a local Hamiltonian and the ground state of the local Hamiltonian, one can prove something in general. But actually, yeah. But let me mention that this ODO, I mean, may not. I mean, we don't have to calculate this ODO or one from ODO for with a Hamiltonian, right? We can calculate it with like a random unitary circuit evolution of a system. As long as the circuit has certain symmetry, we can still define the ODO and calculate there. And there, I expect the behavior of ODO to have a much more exotic and general form because there's no Hamiltonian, there's not even energy conservation, but we can still define them and we can still compute their behavior and compute for example, the merriment-driven transition. How does this ODO behave? Yeah, so there's a lot of things to explore with the concept of a higher form ODO. And actually, so the fractional power of the area, fractional power of the volume, even if it doesn't happen for ordinary local Hamiltonian system, they may happen in those more exotic system without Hamiltonians. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Maybe one last question.
Can I ask?
Sure.
Sure.
This question is actually related to your answer to Yizhi's question. I guess I got confused. So Yizhi was asking if higher form symmetries can be emergent at a critical point. And you gave the example of a U1 gauge theory where there can be emergent U1 higher form symmetry. I thought you referred to the case where the matters still have a gap. So below the gap, you have emergent U1. High form symmetry, but that's not.
So certainly, so suppose I have like a charge one matter field, and charge one matter field becomes a gapless. It's very hard to talk about a one form symmetry. But suppose I have suppose I have a massive charge one, but a massive charge two. Then at the low end, I still have an emergent Z2 one form symmetry, although I don't have a microscopic Z2 one form symmetry anymore.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think for example in a 3+1 dimension, for example, suppose I talk about SU2 gauge field and a certain matter field with, and actually I make the adjoint matter field a gapless matter field, but make the fundamental a gapped matter field. Then there's a conformal window. I think then in the conformal window we can talk about the emergent Z2 one form symmetry of the SU2 gauge field.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, so I think we should stop here. So thank you very much again, Cenk, for a very nice talk. And so we will see you all next week.
Yeah, okay. Bye.
Bye.